Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download.
Hi, it's Friday, April 24th, and we are now in day whatever of coronavirus lockdown. Connie, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, honestly. I mean, it's getting harder to keep the kids out of my Zoom calls during the day. But I am, on the other hand, I think you would agree, becoming a master chef.
Yeah, well, I don't think that I have any future as a math teacher. I am clearly reaching the limits of my capabilities with our 12-year-old son. So I think I'll have to cross that out as a future career.
So lots of things we could be talking about today. Alex, I know that you were really interested in the movie ticketing company Fandango buying Vudu. Why is that?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting story because although the terms were not announced, it was a sad conclusion to Walmart's acquisition of Vudu way back in 2010 for $100 million. The company had tried to figure out a strategy for Vudu for a long time and presumably has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the platform, but it was doomed from the start by a lot of management indecision. The company couldn't really get behind Vudu, and I'm not quite sure why. Digital is so important to Walmart's strategy. It wants to get into Amazon's business. It wants to sell advertising where Amazon makes billions of dollars, and video is key to that. But Vudu was always an also-ran product. It didn't have the same interface or tech capabilities as any of the other platforms, and it found itself in a bidding war with huge platforms like Disney and Apple that were investing in original content. Plus, the big boys, Comcast, Disney, were deciding that they didn't want to let their titles run on other platforms. So it put Walmart in a very difficult position. And I actually think Walmart will pay the price for this mistake with Vudu for many years to come. Especially in these coronavirus times, it's so important for a big box retailer like Walmart to have a digital play.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's just so much competition. I mean, the one that everyone's been sort of most interested in is the mobile-only service Quibi. I still have no idea how to say it, but apparently that's kind of fallen off the charts already. So I think that's going to be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yeah, our kids were not impressed with Quibi. They thought it was a poor substitute for TikTok, and they didn't get it. I don't think we get it either. I don't see anybody paying for this service.
Another wrinkle seems to be potentially a toxic culture bubbling up over there. I mean, you keep seeing executives leaving. I think Variety today or yesterday said another top exec, Megan Imbres, the head of brand and content marketing, is leaving the company. She's just the newest person to leave. There was a woman, the head of content operations, Diane Nelson, who left after 10 months. There was a head of partnerships and advertising, Tim Connolly, who had his position eliminated last year. Janice Min, formerly of Us, stepped down. So that wouldn't seem to bode well for the future of the company either, but who knows?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like it would bode well. Hollywood execs are the first to jump ship if something is not working out. And as they say in Hollywood trade speak, they don't leave a job, they ankle it.
You know these companies are doomed when they raise a shit ton of money before they ever launch. Quibi had raised close to $2 billion, I think, before it launched. Magic Leap, similarly, this week, the maker of the augmented reality headset, had raised, I think, $2.6 billion potentially from investors. And it just laid off half its staff, 1,000 people. It's stepping away from its consumer plans. It's going to focus exclusively on enterprise customers. This company, you knew from the outset, was doomed.
It's a virtual disaster. Speaking of disasters, Marc Andreessen wrote a Jeremiah this past weekend in which he talked about our failure to build. Connie, what were your thoughts on that essay?
You know, I didn't know what to make of it. I still don't, honestly. Andreessen is so smart. He's hilarious. He's an excellent writer, better than most full-time journalists, I know, candidly. But he's also been quiet publicly for a really long time, and I wasn't sure what he was aiming for in this piece. Yes, it was encouraging founders to build, and it was rooted in the lack of preparation in the U.S. to the coronavirus pandemic. But it was very general. It was a general sort of complaint about our complacency, and it was inspiring to a degree. I just think that especially with a vacuum of leadership in this country, if Andreessen wants to sort of send a message about what's broken, get more specific.
Yeah, I totally agree with the word that you used in your article, prescriptive. I think that all of us would have relished something a little bit more prescriptive from Mark Andreessen. It's such a strange time, and we need people who are experts at putting together products quickly to meet a huge demand. And we need the savvy of folks from Silicon Valley to put together supply chains that we can use at the state government level to source some of this stuff.
Speaking of which, we are talking later in the podcast to Todd Chaffee, one of the most senior members of Institutional Venture Partners, about that expressly. But before we get to that, another VC in the news this week was, of course, Bill Gurley. This story came out of the Wall Street Journal. It reported that Benchmark is out raising a new $425 million fund, which is the firm's 10th vehicle. But more dramatically, the star of the firm, Bill Gurley, is segueing out of the firm. This story probably gave a lot of people in Silicon Valley the feels, because Gurley is one of those VCs who founders just love. At the same time, you kind of assumed that he would be moving on from a full-time VC career at some point. He's 53, which in the world of VC is right around the time you start spending more time on your vineyard, yacht, other homes in Montana, Maine, New Zealand. But it raises a second related point, which is that if Gurley is not a billionaire at this point, he has to be pretty close. Don't you think so, Alex?
Most def.
He's been a VC for 20 years at Benchmark, which has been hugely successful. I mean, its bets include eBay, Stitch Fix, OpenTable, Uber. Its partners share equal economics, which is not true of a lot of firms. Bloomberg last year reported that Gurley's stake alone in Uber was around $600 million at the time of its IPO. Of course, that was probably hammered down a bit as Uber's share price fell, but he might also have taken money off the table before the IPO.
I'm sure he made a lot of money off of Uber, but I'm also sure that Travis Kalanick took some years off of his life.
Right, right. He's also very controversial, Gurley. He's highly respected, but he's also kind of a brass knuckle player, has always been my sense. So he orchestrated the ouster of Kalanick in 2017. He also fought with Naval Ravikant of AngelList fame many years ago when Ravikant sued Benchmark over a deal where he accused the firm of withholding information about a proposed merger. Either way, there will probably be at least one team who's happy to see him go, and that is Andreessen and also Ben Horowitz of Andreessen Horowitz. These guys have always been fierce competitors, and Andreessen Horowitz is kind of the anti-Benchmark, given it's a very sprawling firm investing a lot of money, in stark contrast to Benchmark, which was built and remained lean, both in terms of assets under management and the number of people it employs. There was that famous New Yorker story back in 2015 where Mark Andreessen said in a comment that he may have come to regret that he couldn't stand Gurley. He said, if you've seen Seinfeld, Bill Gurley is my Newman. And my impression is that Ben Horowitz feels the same way. I sat down with him last year to talk about his newest book, and his continued disdain for Gurley was pretty evident. We were talking about cultural values, and sort of out of nowhere, he said, you know, so if you get on Twitter and you do what Bill Gurley does and say, you know, quote, that company is a stupid piece of shit, it'll never make a dollar and blah, 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 like you get fired for that, end quote. Meaning Andreessen Horowitz has a very different approach to how it treats founders. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. No love lost there, that's for sure.
Bill Gurley definitely had his problems with Mark Andreessen and vice versa. But I will say that his Above the Crowd column was very informative. And I always felt like he had a great way of articulating his ideas. As a former Wall Street analyst, he was able to really break things down by the numbers and make a case. He and Andreessen are obviously both brilliant, and I'm sure they will miss each other because, as the French say, you need a good enemy.
It's a great point. I always love the writing of both of them. And regarding Gurley, it should be noted that he is remaining on the boards of 11 companies, so he's not disappearing right away.
One thing is for sure, Bill Gurley is not going to be hiding in New Zealand. Bloomberg reported earlier this week that droves of venture capitalists and tech executives were talking about retreating to their bunkers in New Zealand. But there's only one person who was named in the article. I'd still love to know if Peter Thiel and company are winging their way over to New Zealand, but it doesn't seem like it's really happening. What do you think, Connie?
Well, we know for sure that one friend of Thiel's, Sam Altman, is not. He told Bloomberg that he was, in fact, quarantining at home and watching Tiger King on Netflix. But I will say, I talked to a VC last week who I happen to know has a home in New Zealand, and it sounded like he was calling from a tunnel or something. So I had asked this person if perhaps he had made the trip, and he laughingly said, no way, he needs to be closer to the action right now.
Well, it may say something about these times that a bunker is the ultimate status symbol. But from the description in the article, these things are actually really expensive. $3 million for a shelter that can house 10 people. So forget about the Bentley and the yacht. It's all about the bunker.
Up next, our interview with Todd Chaffee, long one of the two senior most partners at Institutional Venture Partners, or IVP as it's known. IVP is one of the biggest venture firms in the world in terms of assets under management, and Chaffee, like Gurley, seems to be taking a step back from the firm, which we gather is probably going to announce a new mega fund any day now based on the fact that it closed its last $1.5 billion fund in 2017. We wanted to talk to Chaffee about mega funds in this market, but also about a new initiative that he and his wife Kat just launched, a foundation to support a fund for first responders called the True Hero Fund. They've funded it to the tune of $1 million and are committing up to $1 million more in matching funds. But first, a word from this week's sponsor. Startups want to hear from the voices they trust for guidance on how to navigate this COVID-19 driven situation. That's why TechCrunch is so excited to introduce Extra Crunch Live, a virtual speaker series complete with live Q&A exclusives for Extra Crunch members. Sign up for Extra Crunch at techcrunch.com to get access to this webinar series. Stay tuned especially. Mark Cuban is sitting down with us on April 30th at 11 a.m. Eastern. You won't want to miss it. Todd, thank you so much for joining us today. As listeners know, Todd joined IVP as a managing director quite a while ago. He's been a general partner since March of 2000. Is that right, Todd?
That's right.
I wanted to talk to you today about a number of things, but first and foremost, we were really interested in your new effort around helping healthcare workers in a time of crisis, this True Hero Fund. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've put together here and why?
We basically put together a pipeline for people to donate directly to medical professionals on the front lines. And it was essentially one of the situations where, like most people, we're self-quarantined and watching this horror show unfold. And it was hard to just sit there and watch our best and brightest go into battle unarmed. And so I looked around for organizations that were directly supporting doctors, nurses, and other frontline medical professionals, and we couldn't find anything. So we decided, well, let's just create something. So we set up the True Hero Fund, and I set up a foundation called the True Hero Foundation to manage and administer the fund. And we literally just set it up this week and just announced it on Tuesday.
So it's $1 million fund and it's being administered by like 15 people. So this is a pretty serious effort.
Basically, the structure is Kat and I are donating $1 million up front just to get it launched. And then we're matching, we committed a second million, so $2 million total. We're matching donations into the fund just to get it rolling. And as we got into it, we started to realize that the PPE issue is a crisis right now. So suddenly I was asking myself, how do we get into the logistics business? But that's what we're doing right now. We figure out how to get PPE to doctors and nurses and other people that really need it. We sent out our first funding on Monday to a neurosurgeon who somehow figured out how to get 2 million N95 masks from China. And he's distributing those to his colleagues around the country. He had to actually borrow some private jets in order to do it, but he did it. And so that's exactly the type of people that we want to fund.
Did you have any personal connection to this crisis? Did you know any doctors that were talking about the lack of PPE, or was this really just driven from what you were seeing in news reports?
Yeah, it was mostly driven from news report. I'm acutely aware and sensitive to the situation. I had a mountain biking accident about 5 years ago, and I broke my neck in seven places and broke seven ribs and both shoulders, and I was in intensive care for 3 days. And then I've had six surgeries since, spinal surgeries and shoulder surgeries, et cetera. I've spent quite a bit of time around doctors, nurses, and been in that vulnerable state. And I really came to appreciate just how heroic and amazing these people are. From my perspective, they're kind of the best and brightest of humanity, right? They're the most evolved. They've chosen to care for other people. And so I'm very sensitive to those people being in trouble. If you think about it, what's really happened is, as a society, we have been invaded by a silent, invisible enemy, and we were completely unprepared for this. And so our soldiers are going into battle without the gear they need. They don't have the helmets or the flak jackets or the machine guns and bullets. And what's happening is this crazy rationing thing where the platoon has one rifle and seven bullets and go in there and fight the battle. The reality is that the doctors and nurses and paramedics, et cetera, are actually dying at a higher rate than our soldiers do in traditional wars like Iraq. And the more we've gotten into this, the more we're finding out it's worse than you think. Well, I think we're all seeing little news clips, the scene within the hospitals. But when you really get into it, you find out they're in dire straits. And what's the crazy thing about it is their families at risk as well. You know, at least when a soldier goes off to war, his family's safe at home. But in this situation, they're having to stay in hotels and go through all sorts of extra expenses and challenges in trying to protect their family. So it's worse than I thought as we got into it. The good news is, since we launched this, we're finding that all sorts of people are interested in helping.
How are you finding individuals to support? Are these folks in your network, or are you making inroads through state and local governments?
We're just going through private citizens. And so, as I said, we just started this. The first phase is really focused on just getting PPE to the right people. So we're in the process of doing that, and we're having to be fairly creative. We found a guy in New York who's got 300,000 KN95 masks, which are FDA approved, and he happened to have them in a warehouse. So we're in the process of distributing those right now in New York. And so through our networks, we're trying to identify where the protective gear is. And essentially what's happening, if you think about it, we have a government that is trying to maneuver and trying to solve the problem, but they're not set up for rapid response. And so private citizens can do things much more quickly. You look at what Mark Benioff did. He was able to get 50 million pieces of PPE in. You know, you think about a traditional venture capital role as a, you basically take funds from endowments and pension plans and sovereign wealth funds, and your job as a VC is to try to route that to the most promising, talented entrepreneurs and then help he or she build a business. And that's essentially what we're doing with this fund, is we're taking donors' money and we're routing it to the best and most promising individuals that are solving this problem with efficiency and speed.
You mentioned that you want to honor them later. What does that mean exactly? I'd read that you want to provide direct support to the workers and their families. Does that mean helping to defray the cost of the hotel rooms that you'd mentioned earlier?
What we're finding is the physicians themselves are in pretty good shape. It's the nurses and paramedics and people that aren't making as much. And it's a crazy situation where you'll have a nurse, they have kids, right? And they're the breadwinner, and they're having to work these 12 to 14 hour shifts 6 days a week. And so who's taking care of the kids? And you know, one nurse, for example, was saying, you know what I really need is I need another computer. I've got five kids that are trying to share one computer while I'm at the hospital. So there's a financial support element. We haven't sorted out exactly how that will be delivered. We're just looking to solve the PPE and COVID test issue at the moment. Then in the interim will be more of this support realm. And a lot of it is really a function of how much we raise with the fund. You know, the challenge here is, I think people are inherently good and they want to help. And the question is, how do they help, right? One of the analogies that I've used is, when talking to people about this, is it's the situation is very similar to there's a fire in the neighborhood and your neighbors are running in there trying to get their kids out, are you going to just stand by and watch? Or are you going to try to help out? And most people want to help. The reason we created the fund is to create that mechanism so people can help and know that it's going right to the people that really need it and with efficiency. One of the challenges when you get into a place where you have significant resources is, how do I donate and get maximum impact? You want to make sure that you're getting a return on your charitable investment, so to speak.
Todd, can I ask you, do you think Silicon Valley is doing enough? Vox, for example, has covered some of the philanthropic efforts of some of the moneyed investors and founders in the area, and also a lack of some of these efforts, or perhaps they're just sort of flying under the radar. I'm just wondering if you think there is anything to be said for whether or not people in your network are doing enough.
You know, I haven't done a really thorough inventory. I think the answer is there's so much need right now at so many levels. I think there's a gut check for anybody who has resources, which is, if you're not really helping out, you need to look at yourself really carefully. We've chosen to focus on these frontline medical professionals because they're so critical. There's so many people that are out of work and people that are struggling to eat. And so it's a clarion call for anybody with resources. It's time to get involved.
Todd, I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about IVP, again, where you've been for decades, and the market more broadly. But before we move on, I did want to remind people where they can donate to your charity, which is trueherofund.org. Trueherofund.org. So, yes.
Yeah, trueherofund.org, yeah. The only thing I can tell people about that is we'll make sure that the resources are directed to the right people.
Terrific. Thanks, Todd. So, on to IVP. So I think it's interesting. We're seeing so many of these funds of IVP's ilk, meaning top funds, raising enormous amounts of money. It's a good time to be an investor. There's a lot of softness, I guess, in the market. I did notice that IVP had last announced a fund in 2017. I assume one is coming that you cannot talk about unless you can talk about it.
We're currently investing IVP 16. So that's all I can tell you right now.
You've been through a number of these ups and downs. Sometimes when I see these big funds, I'm reminded of what happened during 2000 when some of the funds seemed to be too big suddenly in scope. In this case, you know, I'm guessing check sizes are going to get smaller. I'm just wondering, do you think it's the time to sort of bulk up or size down, or how do you see this moment in time?
I think it's a time to be, as a VC, very careful. All the venture capitals right now are extremely busy tending to their portfolio. Like most firms, we've gone through our portfolio and put our portfolio companies into green, yellow, and red categories. We're fortunate because, as you know, we're later stage growth investors. So our portfolio is very big and strong, and we have the luxury of kind of cherry picking the best companies in the venture pipeline. So 92% of our companies are either profitable, funded to profitability, or have more than 12 months of cash. So my heart goes out to the early stage firms that I'm sure they're just having a hell of a time trying to triage through their portfolio. So that's one very large aspect of the business right now. And then in terms of capital deployment, my input is to be very careful with deployment of capital right now, because we don't know where we are in this recovery. We don't know if this is some sort of modified V-shaped recovery. We don't know if this is a U. I mean, there is also the L, which some people have talked about, where we're just on this general decline. We have come off a period of tremendous exuberance, and we are now moving into the great reset of valuation. And I've seen this before. The public markets will correct, and it takes usually a couple quarters for the private market to really realize that the game has changed. And that's what's happened. So any capital that's deployed right now, you have to be really certain that there's a strong rationale for making that investment right now.
You've been through the low points of a cycle. I'm just wondering what this means for IVP's model, which is growth investing. Does that mean that you will have fewer targets to choose from moving forward?
The situation we just had, right, prior to the COVID crisis was way too much capital in the market, right? Too much capital chasing too few opportunities. And it's not that hard to spot companies that are exceptional, right? And so anytime there's a company that has traction and is growing well and has a great team and all the things that you're looking for in terms of a product that's really delivering a strong value proposition, competitive dynamics that are favorable, et cetera, anytime you have that attractive venture investment, there has been a tremendous amount of capital chasing that opportunity. And guess what? The valuations have been crazy, off the charts. Now we have a situation where we have this valuation reset going on. There's still a lot of capital, but the capital's really busy tending to the existing companies. And I think it's a little more cautious. So people aren't going to go way over the top with their term sheets. And we should see a situation where valuations start to slowly come down. And for us, we get more access to the top companies. They're a little more open to taking capital from another firm. And any smart CEO out there right now, if they can raise the capital, they should, because the valuation trend is going to go down here for quite some time.
Todd, how do you guys think about the IPO market? Obviously, it was open and then it started to kind of swing in the other direction last year. Now it's shut for who knows how long. In terms of thinking about how long you hold investments, how has that timeline changed?
Well, as you mentioned, I think the IPO market is completely shut and it's going to be shut for a while. So your exit environment really becomes the M&A world. The good news is the big tech giants out there have significant balance sheets. They have a lot of cash on hand. And the smart ones will start making acquisitions. And so I think we're going to see a lot more M&A activity. And that actually sometimes, believe it or not, makes it easier as a VC because the company's acquired, boom, it's done. You know, you had a nice return, time to go home. Frankly, some of the hardest decisions we have is when you have a company, you look at it, you find a great company like a Twitter or a Snap or something like that. It's a fight to get in there and win that deal, right? So it's easy to figure out whether you want to invest. The hard part on those investments is once it's gone public and you've had a great return, then you're really in a situation like, wow, do we keep riding this growth or do we step aside? And those are hard. Those decisions are hard. So in some respects, it becomes a lot easier when your exit is just handled for you through an M&A event.
IVP is not an investor in Airbnb, so I hope you won't mind my asking. What do you think of the $2 billion in debt that this company has taken on?
I haven't gotten into the details. I haven't looked at it. I saw it kind of at a headline level for Airbnb. But I think there is a lesson there for any entrepreneurs or CEOs that are listening. The qualities of Airbnb are incredibly strong on many fronts. And I think what this valuation is essentially half their last round, 50% plus terms around it. So that should be a message to other CEOs about this valuation reset that I'm talking about. Over the years, I've always been amazed at CEOs. They always have a tendency to overvalue their company. I think it's just a natural trait of being an entrepreneur and being optimistic. But there's a new reality that's starting to set in here.
Todd, I also just wanted to ask if you have any thoughts about changing players, if you think that IVP specifically will see different players at the table, maybe other players that you might see less. SoftBank's obviously struggling. I'm wondering about corporate VCs who usually take a step back when their companies are getting hammered in the public market. How has this changed, or do you anticipate it will change?
What we normally see in these contractions and corrections is that the tourists leave. That means the hedge funds, mutual funds, corporate VCs, all the sovereign wealth people, the billionaires, family offices, they have a tendency to retreat in these environments. And so what's left are the people, the professionals full time working in the venture industry. And, you know, we have capital. We have a lot of capital.
Todd, your website says that you are an advisory partner. When did that change happen and what does that mean? Are you still actively involved in the firm and voting on deals? Do you lead deals? What exactly is the meaning of advisory partner?
That's a program that we established a couple of funds ago. Essentially, the way our firm operates is each of the partners are managing directors and general partners of each fund. And then what we built is a program where you could be a managing director and an advisory partner once you've kind of done your time, so to speak, if you've been through many funds, and then you have the luxury of stepping back to pursue things like philanthropy, like I have been. Norm Fuglesang was the first partner that took advantage of that program. I was the second partner. And then we've built it as essentially an off-ramp for senior partners to step down. The challenge of the venture business is you can't just parachute out. It's a little bit like the old MacArthur thing, you know, old soldiers never die, mm-hmm. Old VCs, we just fade away, right? And so the role is to provide guidance and wisdom as much as we can to the younger team. And then also we have to manage our existing portfolios where we're on the board, et cetera. And I'm super proud of the program that we put together because it builds institutional stability for our firm.
It sounds a little bit like the Benchmark situation. New fund coming up, you're taking a step away, you'll still be on hand as an advisor. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we call it an advisory partner because you're still in the Monday partner meetings, you're still working your companies, you're still interfacing with LPs. It's just less of a demand in terms of going out and finding new investments.
Sure.
A big part of it is just to provide the pattern recognition. When you've been in this for a long time, you start to see some patterns, and the younger professionals may not have seen those situations. So we've worked really hard to create a dynamic of the energy and hustle of the younger team and then try to bring the sage wisdom of the older folks.
Got it. Just to be clear, you're not on any boards right now. Is that correct?
I'm working a few companies, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. I just wondered, what do you think the future holds for you? I mean, would you pull a Jim Breyer and start a family office investing only your own capital and maybe not worrying about limited partners? Or what do you think are next steps for you? Because though you may have been with IVP for a long time, you're still a pretty young guy.
I'm still in the next fund. So I've got, I'm still working. IVP still takes a lot of my time, which is great. I am spinning up my charitable work. I was focused on the climate crisis. That was really the primary focus that I was targeting here. But then along came this coronavirus COVID situation. So that kind of detoured my efforts. Once this dies down and we get through the COVID crisis, then I'll go back to the climate crisis, which frankly, from my perspective, really should be called a climate emergency.
Sure.
If you really look at it, we are in the sixth mass extinction here. Mother Earth is fine, but the question is, will we as humanity make it through this? That's an area that I want to continue to focus on. And then I also want to target unity in general. I feel like we've moved into this very divisive model of interacting with one another, and I'd like to see us try to be a little more unified in our view of humanity and the way we interact.
That's great. That's actually kind of intriguing. On a practical level, what do you have in mind there? Can you solve this for us?
Doing away with social media?
You know, it's funny. I have this love-hate relationship with social media because we've made a lot of money with investments in Twitter and Snap. I remember when Ev Williams and Biz Stone pitched us in January 2009. And they came in and said that they want Twitter to be the pulse of the planet. And the more I've looked at it, I'm realizing that at some level, it's the collective community kind of wiring itself up to be able to communicate. We've kind of stumbled into this new resource as a society, and we don't really know how to manage it yet, right? We have instant communications, and the best of us shows up, and the worst of us shows up. I have an overall view that we're moving away from this tribal, selfish, animalistic behavior where self-preservation and individual comfort is the name of the game. And we're starting to realize that we're actually, in fact, one collective being that's growing and thriving. And when you move into that state, that unity consciousness, you realize that you really have to help one another.
Well, I do think COVID-19 has had a grounding effect on a lot of us, which is good. Todd, such a pleasure talking to you. We so appreciate you making time for us. And I wish you a lot of luck with your fund. I hope it gains some needed traction.
Okay. Thank you for the time.
Thanks, Todd. Take care.
That's a wrap. Another show in the books. Thanks, everybody.
Not a minute too soon. You can hear our kids screaming in the background. Bye. Thank you, everyone.